Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
This talk contains more explicit and sensitive content and is geared towards a mature audience only. Audience discretion is advised. Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Minkin. I'm a general pediatrician and proud JOMA member. And tonight I'm really honored and really excited to be interviewing Suri Halpern. Before I introduce her, I'm going to say, as I always do, if you have a topic you want to hear, if you want to be interviewed, you know someone you want to be interviewed, you have comments on the podcast, please reach out to us at health, H-E-A-L-T-H, at joma.org. We want to hear from you. And this podcast is on request of one of our listeners who asked me to do an episode with a sex therapist, which is what Suri Halpern is. Obviously, this topic is for mature audiences only. Suri Halpern is a licensed marriage and family therapist and certified sex therapist. She runs a private practice in Bala Cynwyd, Pennsylvania, where she sees individuals and couples. She has lectured extensively on a variety of topics involving sexuality. She is passionate about giving women support and information about sexuality at all life stages. She has run training programs for mikveh attendants, kala teachers, rebbetzins, and yoatzot. And she can be found at Sarah Halpern, that's S-A-R-A-H, Halpern at Psychology Today. Welcome, Suri. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's an honor. I'm really excited. And this is a requested topic. We got a request specifically for me to talk to a sex therapist. And I am going to say that I didn't call this the sex therapy talk. I called it Intimacy Matters. And we spoke about this a little bit before, that the reason that I did that is because a sex therapist does not just deal with the act of sex. They were talking about the whole larger picture, which is really more connected to what we call intimacy. And I'm going to give you a chance to talk about what I mean by that.
Okay. So, you know, people ask me, like, what exactly is a sex therapist and what do you do? Right. So in my opinion, all of this is just really filtered through my experience and my thoughts. But I think a good sex therapist is somebody who creates a space for people to come in and share whatever concerns they're having about intimacy and sexuality. And they are deeply intertwined. Because in order to have a positive sexual experience, people need to feel free and able to connect to another person. And in order for that to happen, there's some fundamentals of intimacy that need to be established in the relationship. And so often when people come in with concerns around sexuality, it's not just the mechanics. So the mechanics, you can buy Cosmo. You can buy, you know, I don't know. Oh, I'm so old. I don't know if anybody.
I'm like, yeah, I know that.
I'm like, okay.
Sure.
You know, you can go online and Google mechanics.
Right.
The sex therapy is not really about mechanics per se. It's about the entire experience of a person and their sexual self and how to get access to that in a way that makes them feel good and whole.
That's a really good explanation. I like that. How do you train to become a sex therapist? What does that entail?
So for me personally, I first became a licensed marriage and family therapist. And then I did a year of training in Philadelphia at the Council for Relationships, where they have a special sex therapy track. And that was a year of coursework. Then after that, there's a certification process by this organization called ASECT, where you have to have, I believe it's 50 hours of supervision with someone who's a senior clinician, in which you present cases where a variety of different sexual concerns. there's an hours requirement, maybe like 300 or 500 hours worth of actual clinical work. And then you write up this whole thing and they review your application, and that's how you get certified. It is very important when people seek out sex therapists to look for someone who's certified. There are excellent couples therapists who do sex therapy and do a beautiful job with it. But that's not always the case, right? So if you're in couples therapy with someone who's not certified in sex, and they're perfectly comfortable talking to you and your partner about sexuality, and it's working for the two of you, that's great. But there are couples therapists that will never ask the couple about their sex lives because they themselves are uncomfortable. And so if that's your experience, then it's good to look for somebody who's actually certified.
It does. And I'm wondering, do you work with regular relationship type therapists hand in hand?
I do. I will sometimes get a couples therapist who'll say, can you see this couple about this issue? Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll end up coaching that person if they have an established connection with the people, if they've been working with them for a long time, and I'll offer to do some coaching. Other times the people will come see me for a short period of time and then they'll go back. It's more common for me to have an individual therapist contact me and say, look, I have this person who's been seeing me, but it's really a couple's sexual issue. Can you see them as a couple?
But does it go the other way that you're seeing a couple and saying, hey, you need to work more on your relationship? And that's above and beyond what you do. Is that true?
What you mean, work on your relationship independent of sexuality?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm not being clear. Okay, I'm going to let you talk a little bit about what you do. Maybe I'll understand.
Okay. So I see individuals and couples, right? Mm-hmm. I see people for sexuality concerns, but I also see people for a host of other marital concerns.
Oh, so that's working together.
Yes.
I see.
If a person is coming in a relationship with a sexual concern, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say like a typical presentation in a couple will be a disparate desire, which means one person has high desire, one person has low desire. That's how the couple has tagged themselves. They've given each other these labels and they're fighting about it, right? They're having conflict about it. The higher desire identified partner is feeling quite rejected by the person who's always saying no, mm-hmm. right? And the person who's the lower desire partner is feeling very put upon and a lot of pressure. And so they'll come in, and then when we start to talk, it's never just about the sex. Mm-hmm. It's never just about that. The relational experience with the other person is always in play. What's the marital friendship like? How much do they understand each other? How much do they seek each other out for things other than sex, as a friend, as a partner? How willing are they to be vulnerable with that person? How safe do they feel? So there's a whole host of relational things that can be worked on that all can support and facilitate a much stronger sexual connection for the couple.
Excellent. What about other common reasons to come to you?
Okay, so I would say the number one issue that I see from women is lack of desire. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting. I don't know if this is just a recent phenomenon, but in my practice, the lack of desire are now in two clusters. It's people who are in the early stages of marriage, who a lot of them had no sexual experience, you know, very religious women, no sexual experience whatsoever before marriage. And they could not be less interested in this activity. And they're like, I was supposed to be excited about this and I'm not, right? That's one group. And another group of women that have recently been coming in more and more are more mature women who miss their old sexual selves. They're like, hey, where'd my libido go? You know, it used to be my steady companion, my buddy, and it was a good resource for me and my partner. And now it's much harder for me to access that. So I would say that's probably the number one presentation that I'm seeing from women. And from men, there are some struggles around sexual functioning, mm-hmm. which if after they've been to a urologist and they've been medically cleared, I'll get a call saying, this is not a medical issue. This is a psychological, emotional issue, right? Mm-hmm. So then there's work around what is the man's experience with himself in the relationship. And there's a lot of performance anxiety. And also with men who are aging, whose bodies are not responding necessarily the way they used to, mm-hmm. there's a lot of worry about disappointing the partner. And sometimes in response to that worry, there's avoidance. So the number one reason that couples stop having sex is because the male partner stops initiating. And when that happens, it can be very hurtful on both sides.
And could this go back to that different desire, these particular patterns?
But in that case, often the male will say, I don't have the desire I used to have. And the women will sometimes be carrying the desire for the couple. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's a very interesting phenomenon when you think about couples as a system, mm-hmm. right? As a system. And so one person is going to be carrying the desire more so than the other one. And there's often a reciprocity there, right? Like, so if I know that my partner is more interested in initiating, I don't worry about that, right? I don't worry about, oh, are we ever going to have sex again if I don't initiate? Because I know he will, mm-hmm. theoretically, right? So one of the ways that I've really helped people, I hope, to think about this is, let's say in a couple where the higher desire partner is coming across as demanding, right? Mm-hmm. The other person is feeling put upon in that way. One of the ways to think about that is your partner is holding on to sexuality for your relationship. They're keeping it for both of you. They're not letting it slip away. So to be grateful to the person who's not letting sex disappear from the relationship, even if you're not quite ready to participate into the same degree that they are, but the fact that they're willing to say, I still want you, mm-hmm. I still want us to work on this, I want this to be a part of our lives, is actually something to be grateful for. And so it's a way to shift out of resentment mm-hmm. and demand to gratitude.
It's a reframing.
Yeah.
Right.
And the thing is, it's actually true, right? So reframing works when it resonates with them as reality, right? I can reframe and be as positive as I want, but if people don't buy it, it's like, right? But once they realize, you know what, once people can say, oh, you know what, he or she really wants me and they really want this for us. So then it's not just this demand, rejection kind of scenario. Does that make sense?
No, it does. I mean, it sounds like there is an initial reason for some kind of dysfunction, and then there's the emotional overlay on top that makes it so much worse.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we are, at least in this country, we are given very, very distorted messages about sexuality. It's either hypersexual or shame, right? It's like the pendulum swings in crazy directions. And so there's very little around just health, positive, healthy sexuality that's going to have normative ups and downs across your life, right? In every relationship, there's going to be times where there's going to be more sex and less sex. You're going to feel more connected and less connected. And just sort of the normalizing the ups and downs in a couple's relationship over time.
That makes a lot of sense. I want to go back to the younger people you see and talk more about them. Okay. And I want to put a plug before I forget for talking to your kids at an age-appropriate way about sex so that they understand more. And I have done some podcasts and I'm going to link it to this episode. So we're not going to discuss it today. That's not what you do, but I'm just putting that plug out there. And mm-hmm. I want you to go back to your youngest clients.
Okay. First of all, I think it's wonderful that you did those podcasts, by the way. I think it's super important. Mm-hmm. Okay. So young couples who come in, and this doesn't happen infrequently. Often it's people with no sexual experience at all. So unfortunately, the educators of sexuality for young from men is often pornography. Mm-hmm. So even if guys are not compulsive porn users, most religious men have seen porn at some point. It gets passed around in yeshiva, whatever. They've seen it. So there's some learning about sexuality that happens from exposure to pornography. Women in ultra-Orthodox circles are not viewing pornography, at least the women that I've worked with. I can't say everybody, but most of the women who are raised in more religious environments, mm-hmm. not, so their education is, they're coming from different places.
Right.
So the men need to be re-educated that what they've seen in porn is not what women want. And it's an unrealistic expectation of sexuality, right? So there's a lot of things that they've seen, or they think that that's what should be happening when most women don't want to have that experience, right? So, and then there's also the issue of pain. If people, if young women come in and they, you know, a lot of couples just, they work on it in the beginning and they end up getting to a good place completely on their own and they don't need any help, they're fine. But if a woman's first experience with sexuality is very painful, she's not going to want to do it again, right? We gravitate away from pain and towards pleasure. Sex is supposed to be a place you can go for mutual pleasure. But if there's pain and people are just telling this young woman, oh, just grin and bear it, it'll get better, that's not actually good information to give a young woman. Because often there's some things that she can do that are very helpful, that help, you know, if there's vaginismus, which is a tightness mm-hmm. of the muscles. So there's pelvic floor PT, which is enormously helpful.
Wait, I did a podcast for that. I'm going to link that too.
Oh, okay. Excellent. So I've worked with some really wonderful pelvic floor PTs who care deeply about their patients. And I have seen the transformation. So it's slow, but over time, once the body learns to relax, then there's so much room for the couple to explore and have pleasure together and enjoy each other. So that has been a really gratifying part of the work that I've done, is seeing kind of these couples who come in and they're like, this is not working for us. And they're so disappointed. And they feel very alone because it's not the kind of thing they're talking about right. with their friends, right? So they feel very alone. And I've heard women say, there's something wrong with me. How come everybody else doesn't have this problem? Only me, which is not true, right? It's a highly treatable issue because many people come in with this as a concern, right?
Right.
And I have actually seen that really change for couples. One of the good things about having a sex therapist help couples while they navigate this is it supports the couple, right? It gives them a place where they can talk about this and to help them not fall into any kind of dynamic of demand and rejection. And then often with the men, if they're sensitive, they're worried about hurting the partner.
Right.
So they can develop a sort of a secondary ED to this right. situation because they start to feel like, I don't want to hurt the person that I love, the person that I just married, right? So it's helping people kind of be able to find security, safety, and comfort in their own bodies, and also in how they talk to each other about it. And so that's why the sex therapy is a really good, almost like a container, functions as a container for the couple to support them and help them navigate the process.
Right. I'm going to put in a plug for just regular gynecologists and regular doctors as well. I mean, I think of this as a team approach, right?
Yeah.
To make sure that the anatomy is normal and there's no other conditions.
Sure. Yeah. I will say that not all gynecologists are created equal.
Mm.
So I've had women who've had wonderful experiences with sensitive, amazing gynecologists. And some people have not had that experience. So it's a good thing to research before you go and to find out if the gynecologist is comfortable
right.
dealing with sexuality, and not all of them want to, right? So that's the kind of thing that I would ask about before scheduling an appointment. Yeah.
That's a really important point.
Yeah.
Okay. So you would say that the other large group would be older people, maybe going through, say, for women, menopause?
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm going to move to that age now.
Okay. Okay. So I love working with the menopausal women. Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
We need more of you.
Yeah. I love working with them. Yeah. Because these are women who've had a lot of life experience, right? And one of the things that happens is people will kind of tag themselves as that part, I'm done. Like, you know, on your forehead, I'm done. That part of my life is over. I'm not interested in that anymore. It's not for me, right? And it is because we have this performance-based concept of sexuality that our
so also ageism, okay?
Ageism, right. When do you see mature people like in film
right.
really having a beautiful sexual experience? It's always young people that are depicted. And there actually is a wonderful book called Magnificent Sex. And it was put out by this therapist named Peggy Klein-Platz. It's based on research she's done in Canada. And the book basically says, we wanted to find out from couples who had been married a very long time, or been together, not necessarily married, a very long time, who identified as having magnificent sex lives, what did they do? Like, why? What is this about? And they did a huge research project on this issue. And the finding was kind of extraordinary in that the number one factor that was predictive or indicative of being able to maintain positive sexuality throughout the length of a long relationship was empathy.
Mm. Comes back to the relationship.
Yeah.
Of course.
And you know, people were like, really? Empathy? Are you, what does that have to do with my sexuality? And so it turns out it has everything to do with it, right? Because if there's empathy, there's a capacity to see the other person. And being seen and understood is a precondition for many people, especially mature people, to be able to relax and kind of let go of all the worries and feel connected to the other person.
Right. And also to understand that there's ebbs and flows and that's normal on both partners, right?
Absolutely.
I love that.
Absolutely. And it's moving away from performance-based sexuality to pleasure-based sexuality. So that you can have a wonderful time with your parts working differently than they did when you were 35, right? And you can still have a great time together and enjoy each other and also laugh. Sex doesn't have to be so serious, right? It can be a place to have fun. So one of the things I just want to make sure that we touch on tonight is the ability to see yourself as a person who can experience pleasure. Right. So one of the first questions I'll ask people is, what brings you joy? Like, how do you experience pleasure? And I always get, nobody's ever asked me that before. Right?
It's sad.
So what would you say?
What would I say?
Yeah. What brings you joy? It doesn't. I'm sorry, which thing?
Food. I don't food. Know.
Okay, great. That's great.
No, I'm just thinking about diet culture and how women are, you know, pushed to restrict and not enjoy. And I'm thinking of the parallels.
Yeah. So let's say theoretically you had come to my office and we were discussing this issue. And I would say, what do you like about food? And we would have a conversation. And then we would really slow it down and talk about the sensory experience of eating, which is, you know, smell and taste and everything, the way it feels, you know, if you're eating something with your hands, the whole kind of experience, how it feels going down your throat and your body, what fullness feels like there's a deconstruction of the sensory experience of the pleasure stimulus, which in this case would be food, right?
Right.
So then I can say to the person, well, you're saying you're not a sensual person, but your description of that meal that you had was one of the most sensual things I've ever heard, right? And they're like, oh, it kind of was. And then we expand it. What are other places where you're in touch with your senses and your sensuality? And you know what? People come up with some really interesting things. One woman said, I love just sitting on the beach. And then she was able to talk about the smell of the ocean, the sound of the waves, the feel of the sand in her toes, right? So there's this whole kind of sensory waking up, because that's really what eroticism is. Eroticism is the part of you, your pleasure self, that gets woken up. And for some people, it's been sleeping kind of like Rip Van Winkle for a long time, right?
Do you see this more for women than for men?
I do, but I do see it. I don't know if that's because more women come to see me, but I have seen that. I do have a few men that I've been working on this with.
Hear my thought process, right? I mean, if I'm comparing it to diet culture and restriction and expectations women have to do all the things, right? As opposed to the right to have pleasure.
Yes, exactly. No, I think you're totally onto it.
Yeah.
Especially religious women who have a to-do list that's insane.
Right.
Right? There's so
women on steroids.
Yes. Right. I said to somebody, I was trying to explain to somebody, a friend of mine, about Pesach and Passover, what was required. And then I was like, you know what? Forget it.
Just forget it. They say, it's going to be Thanksgiving. We have to make a big meal.
Forget it. But there's that constant list of everything to get done. And so where is there space to just kind of be, right?
Someone called it to-do haiku. You're going to sleep and you're rotating it in your mind, and I got to do this and I got to do this.
Right. So so that experience of being able to wake up that part. And one other thing that I think is worth mentioning is, if there is a marked absence of sexual thoughts, right? Like if I say to somebody, oh, do you ever have any sexual thoughts? They're like, what do you mean? Like, do you ever have a thought come into your head about something you'd like to do or do with your partner, or even a fantasy, and there's a marked absence of that? And this has been an interesting thing. In the young Haredi female population who've really not read or seen anything other than G-rated material, right? So some of them, I'm talking about a very small subset of people who come to me for help, right? So for some people, because they've never had exposure to that, they have a difficult time accessing the thought or the fantasy. And they just need like a little jump start to get there. So I actually had recommended to this one young Haredi woman to watch a show on TV. I said, you know, I don't want you to do anything you're religiously uncomfortable doing. And this is just for you, not for your husband, right? But I think it might help you. And her Rav ended up calling me to talk to me about it. And he was wonderful and understanding and gave her the go ahead to do it. And that was all she needed. It was,
wow.
It was just a jump start. And for some people, they can read a book, they can read a romantic novel, and that also feeds the erotic part of the brain for them. But sometimes people need a little bit of a booster to get there.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned a rabbi, because I always have to give my halachic disclaimer that we are here to discuss medical issues and, you know, speak to your own Rav if there's anything that comes up for you. Do you work with Rabbeim?
I do. I will. Yeah, I do. Because depending on the person who comes to see me, sometimes it's very important to them that the Rav be involved. And you want to help people in a way in which it actually works for them. So, yeah. And my experience with that so far has been very positive. Very positive. Yeah.
Right. So anybody could come to you. This is not just for a subsegment of a population of Orthodox Jews or non-Jews, or anybody can do this.
I treat everybody. Yeah.
Yes. And we're you can do this. You go to your Rav if that's something that, you know, you have concerns about, and you can speak to them and they could speak to you or a different therapist.
Yeah.
It's good to have that in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If people are looking for therapists, I think a good question to ask at the beginning is, are you willing to collaborate with other people on my treatment team? And because it's very important for everybody to be talking to each other, to help the person, to give the person the maximum amount of support that they need. I mean, it's always done with consent, and there are always, you know, limitations on what people want you to share. The person is always in charge of what information gets shared. But in general, a collaborative approach is sometimes very helpful to people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're talking about social media, and made me think about social media and movies. And, you know, you had mentioned that you did want to talk about that as well, on the impact on people who do use regularly the media.
Yes. Yeah. So there is, you know, so much wrong and false information and false expectations out there. And so we absorb all of it. And when I have people say to me, we can't schedule sex because then it's not spontaneous. And on TV or in the movies, nobody's scheduling it. They're just going out to dinner, coming home and ripping each other's clothes off. And nobody's ever tired and nobody ever drank too much at dinner, right? It's just, so it's a fantasy. That's what we're paying for. We're paying for the fantasy, for the film. But my response to we can't schedule sex is, everything important in your life, you make time for and you prepare for, right? If you're going to have a meeting at work, if you have a presentation to give, you spend time getting ready for that presentation. If you're hosting a dinner and you want people to enjoy themselves, you prepare, you plan. And when you were dating, you were planning, right? You planned for the date. You got yourself all, you know, fixed up, you showered, you did the whole thing. So this idea that sex has to be spontaneous and coming out of left field is a false reality that is fed over and over again in the media. And so to get people to kind of unlearn that and realize that when they schedule it, because there's something called, in sex therapy, we use a term called priming the pump, which means that I prepare by sending my partner, let's say, a text, can't wait to be with you tonight, or you look beautiful in the morning, a good extra hug, you look so great today, whatever it is, so that the couple knows that the evening is going to end in some positive physical connection, right? So, and that is, you know, a terrific kind of foreplay. That's a foreplay that starts when you're not even in the same room. And that can only happen if you plan for it. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. I'm also back to the woman with the long to-do list and wondering if what you say to those women. I mean, what if they're just too overwhelmed and tired?
Right. So this takes time, right? It takes time for people to say, have you ever been able to say, this is what I need, right? Have you ever been able to say, I'm not going to do that because I can't do it now, or I don't want to, and be able to kind of put the brakes on some of those demands and carve out time just for you. So for some people, they don't really live in that space. And there's a kind of a battle. Am I selfish? Mm. If I do that, am I selfish? But in every sexual encounter, there are moments of utter self-absorption. Like there's a small, even in the most connected sexual experiences, there are moments of utter self-absorption for erotic charges to run through the body. So to normalize that for people, it doesn't mean that you're selfish. It means you're human.
Right. It goes back to giving yourself the right to have pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds so basic.
Right. But there's right. a lot, you know, we're acculturated to right. be givers. It's great to be a giver, right? We're acculturated. So, but in sexuality, you have to have a little bit of selfishness to be able to say, I deserve this.
I'm going to flip the script though, okay? Because when you're experiencing pleasure, you may be giving your partner pleasure that you have that pleasure. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And actually the number one turn on, I don't know where they got these statistics from, but this is what they taught me when I trained as a sex therapist. I'm just going to tell you that they say that one of the number one turn-ons in heterosexual couples for a male partner is to see the female partner experiencing pleasure from him. That's a huge turn on for the other person. So, I mean, it makes sense, right?
Right.
Right. You care about the person, you want them to be having a good time. It's like, you know.
Right.
There is one other thing. Do we have time to talk about?
We do, but we do have to leave time for your successful outcome stories. But anyway, yes.
Oh, okay.
I'm not going to forget about that.
Okay, so I'll just do this very quickly. And whenever I speak, I mention the difference between spontaneous and responsive desire, because I just think it's like a fact of sexuality that should be out there. And a lot of people are learning about it, which is wonderful. But whenever I present, I always have somebody come up to me at the end and say, I wish I knew that when I was first married. So spontaneous versus responsive desire. Spontaneous desire is desire that kicks in response to stimulation from either yourself or your partner, right? Spontaneous desire is I'm walking down the block and all of a sudden I'm like, well, it would be great to have sex tonight. So there have been some analysis of this, and some people don't like that it's so gendered, but in my experience, more men present with spontaneous desire and women generally respond with responsive desire. So this is the catch 22 for women. If my body needs to be turned on to send a message to my brain, oh, this is a good idea, we should do this. How do I get there if my brain is like, no, I don't think so? But if my body gets a cue from my partner, like, oh, this could be a lot of fun. So if women understand that that's what it takes, it's more about a willingness to see where your body will take you to let desire kick in. Mm-hmm. So if you can kind of wrap your brain around that, like, it's okay. Oh, I'm not in the mood. Okay, maybe you're not in the mood. Maybe there's legitimate reasons and that has to be respected. But if things in the relationship are pretty good and you would really like to be more sexual, but you're like, I'm not in the mood. This idea about spontaneous desire is helpful. Like, maybe I should give myself a chance mm-hmm. to see if with this willingness window, if I open it up, if desire will kick in. And it's not a guarantee. I'm not signing a contract, right? But I'm giving myself the opportunity to have that experience.
Right. You're also normalizing that other path. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that's important. Yeah. I want to hear your stories, please.
Oh. Okay.
Don't leave me yet.
Okay. So, so in terms of successes or not success, because I hate to talk about sexuality as success or failure, but let's say in terms of people being able to experience things that they hadn't been able to experience before, there's been quite a few people who, I had one woman who was unable to have an orgasm, which there are some women that, you know, I think the statistics are 10 to 15% of women will never have an orgasm or have suffered from that. Anyway, this woman thought she was in that category, but she did the work with herself and her own narratives about sexuality, about shame and acceptance of her body. And her partner was extremely supportive of her. And then she said to me, now I know what all the fuss was about.
Wow.
So
10 to 15%, really though?
Yeah. I also thought that was high, but that's what they say.
Maybe those are people who didn't get sex therapy.
Maybe. There's, I think people should keep trying.
Yeah. Who should come to you?
Really, individuals who are struggling with any kind of negative experience or feeling about themselves in terms of sexuality. Couples who are struggling and want their sexual connection to be something more positive and are finding themselves in conflict over it. And I think really anybody who is looking to explore this part of themselves in a safe and supportive way is welcome to contact me.
Right. So how can they reach you?
Okay, so you can reach me on Psychology Today. My listing is Sarah Halpern.
S-A-R-A-H Halpern.
Correct. Yeah.
You got it. I have to thank you so much for doing this with me.
I really thank you for inviting me in and letting me be part of this whole Joma educating the world. I love it.
It is. It's fantastic. And I'm really grateful to you. Thank you so, so much.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
You too. And have a good Shabbos.
You too. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Joma Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at joma_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOWMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.